Hey, welcome aboard. Thanks for checking the podcast out. Got a really fun, funny guest, legendary comic. We're going to talk about him in a minute. But before I get to that, what is inside a mustard packet that they don't want you to see? I can't break into one of those things for the life of me. I can't rip it open. I used an M80. I can't get into it. They don't put a little line, little black line where you rip here. They don't pre-rip it for you. What is so special about mustard that we can't get into a mustard packet? I gotta go when I'm on the road and I want a little mustard with like a chunk of cheese. I gotta go buy an entire jar of mustard. Okay, I can't live like. Meanwhile, ketchup. Oh, you can rip that open just looking at it. It's like the horror of condiments. It's just ketchup just everywhere. Yeah, it just spreads its legs, you know. But meanwhile, the mustard packet's like a gold digger, you know. It's a gold digger of condiments. You pay for it, but you ain't getting inside. All right, my guest this week, Kevin Nealon, great, great comic legend from SNL, the Mr. Subliminal character, the Hans and Franz character. It just from the Showtime show, Weeds. Really cool conversation with him. He's so funny in this, and I was really excited to have him on because I've really admired him for a long, long time. So enjoy the podcast, please. Send the link around to your friends. We want to keep building subscribers and get a lot of cool guests, as you know. And please leave a nice comment if you haven't done so, or have your friends do it on iTunes. All right. Enjoy Kevin Nealon. I'm here in New York City with a legendary comedian. Am I allowed to say that? No, don't look around. I'm talking. just a few like minor credits. Starred in the Showtime series Weeds. An SNL cast member, not really heard of that show, but I heard it's pretty good, 1986 to 1995, where you were Weekend Update anchor. You came up with Mr. Subliminal, which I need to talk to you about because I think it's so hilarious. Hans or Franz and Hans, and movies up the ass, Happy Gilmore, yeah. Daddy Daycare, Roxanne with Steve Martin, which I'm fascinated about, the great Kevin Nealon.
Yay!
Well, you were, what, 8 or 9, and your dad bought you a recorder, and you kind of started playing.
I remember he had a one of those reel-to-reel tape recorders. It was a nice one. It had a leather case on it. You know, it was about 1 foot by 8 inches. And and nobody really had, you didn't see many of those around back then.
Right.
And I loved hearing my voice, recording my voice. Mm-hmm. So I would try to do impressions and stuff back then. You know, it'd be like, back then it was like Jimmy Stewart and all those kind of guys.
And would you, like, if I read correctly, you sort of would, like, even MC, like, as a comedian at birthday parties and stuff like that?
What I would do is I would memorize the jokes in the back of the Parade magazine. It was a segment in the Sunday paper. And in the back, they had, at the time, the popular comedians then. And they had, like, a column of their jokes.
Yeah.
Like, maybe 10 jokes.
Yeah.
And I loved reading those jokes. And so I would start to memorize those. And this is when I was about 18, 17. Mm-hmm. And when I go to like neighborhood parties, you know, we're standing around my friend's house drinking with friends, I would get in a little group and I'd retell these jokes, but I made them mine. You know, like one of them I still remember to this day. It was, hey, did you guys hear about this guy downtown? He robbed a fire truck. The guy actually robbed a fire truck. And they're like, no way. I said, yeah, yeah. And I'm waiting for them to, like, probably more. And they go, what happened? What did they get the guy? I said, yeah, some guy that stole a cop car arrested him.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I would watch, one of the things I always asked my parents to do and they let me do was watch The Tonight Show if there was a comedian on. I'd get to stay up late.
Yeah.
And one was like, would be like Rodney Dangerfield or whatever. And then I'd go in and I remember standing in the locker room. I think maybe I was a freshman in high school, maybe sophomore. And I just start doing the jokes, and the kids were laughing at them, right? And I, you know, and then they knew that they were from a comedian that I saw, and I just remember that feeling. But it never—I didn't know then that this was going to be my path. I had a whole other career as a lawyer and a banker, and I quit to be a comedian. But
nice move,
yeah. it's like how can I give my mother a heart attack? But so you worked with somebody. We worked with the same person together, and I want to know what your experience was like.
Hated them.
A. Whitney Brown.
Yeah.
Well, I worked on The Daily Show as a writer for a number of years, and he had the office next to me, and he was very, very funny, but very passive aggressive, and would do these subtle things to bust your balls.
Yeah.
He also had the single best interview technique. You know, we would do the field pieces, which are basically parodies of
the 60 Minute pieces. So he'd go out into a town somewhere, and there'd be some mayor or whatever who's got this cockamamie idea for something, right? So he'd start to talk to the guy, and he'd be like, and you know, he's very super serious. He goes, so Kevin, you're a good mayor. Yep. And people here think you're honest. Yep. Trustworthy. Yep. Smart. Yep. Inventive. A little odd. An idiot. A moron. And the guy just, and then he keeps going, and the guy just keeps nodding and nodding. Yeah. And then before you know it, he sucked the guy in. What was he like on SNL? Because you were there from 1986 to 1995 with an amazing cast of Dana Carvey, you, Nora Dunn, Phil Hartman, Dennis Miller.
Jan Hooks.
What was he like then? I'm just curious because he's a character.
Yeah, he is a character. Whitney was a nice guy. He was really interested in politics and I think social, you know, events and pop culture that things were going on. He was a good writer, very good writer. I remember one of his jokes that I loved was, he would say, oh, even if you're, you know, there's so many people in China, there's like, you know,
five billion.
Even if you're a one in a million kind of guy, there's, you know, 500 million just like you. And then his joke is he would introduce himself. He goes, I am not the Whitney Brown. I am a Whitney Brown. Something like that. But yeah, he was really, and he loved doing pieces on Weekend Update, you know, about politics. And he had a really interesting slant on things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. he was a good writer. Yeah. And I haven't seen him lately. I don't know what he's doing now.
Yeah, I haven't seen him.
Last time I saw him, he was in Florida. But I think he got married a couple of years ago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I think he was living in Connecticut. You grew up in
Bridgeport.
Yeah. And I grew up in Rhode Island, and I know that area because we got a place up in Stonington. And so we go up in Trumbull. I think you grew up
Trumbull.
Yeah. And,
well, Bridgeport, actually.
In Bridgeport. Did you live in Trumbull or something?
I went to school in Trumbull for a couple of years.
So when you're growing up and you're sort of, you know, I think you moved to L.A. and, like, right out of college?
I was 23 or 24 when I moved to L.A. with a friend of mine because I wanted to get into stand-up. I like you, I love stand-up. I would get the TV guide, and I would highlight. I would go through the whole week and highlight, circle all the comics that were going to be on the talk shows that week. And I make sure I saw them because I don't think we had VCRs back then.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, I loved watching. I just loved the craft of them coming out, being on stage with usually no props or anything, and just getting people to laugh. And that was their job.
Yeah.
And they traveled around like that. So I waited for my buddy to graduate college, and I said, let's go out to California, kind of check it out. Because I had been to New York. I checked out the Catch a Rising Star, and this comedy club was so intimidating because it was a New York club. And I was always intimidated by New York itself. I lived an hour and 15 minutes away. I came in here maybe five times with school trips, and that was it, to go to the museums.
Yeah.
So I went to the Catch a Rising Star to check it out, and it was just jammed with people. And you could smoke back then. Everybody's smoking, and the comics were on stage. They're right on top of the audience, and guys like Richard Belzer are, you know, emceeing, and Barry Diamond, Ellis Levinson was another comic, Ed Bluestone, Elaine Boozler, all of these like kind of New York people that really, and it scared me. And I thought, I would love to see California. Plus, I know the stand-up out there is probably more laid back because it has that reputation. Stand back.
Oh, you
know,
okay. Like, even Steve, then it had that rep.
Yeah, because Steve Martin was from L.A., or that's where he lived, and some of these other comics, and it wasn't that New York tough scene.
Yeah.
But so,
Did you know, just out of curiosity, when did that turn happen for you that you went from fan to this is going to be my career or at least pursuit? Like, were you in high school when you were at Sacred Heart college? Or
for me, Paul, I always loved music, and I always kind of saw myself as being in a band or being like a James Taylor kind of a singer. Yeah. You know, I loved playing the guitar.
Well, I heard your music, and I didn't see you being in a band.
No, I didn't. I was in a heavy metal band that was not successful because we would smash our instruments before the first song.
You did. You sucked me in there.
Yeah. So, and I also like comedy. I love pranks. I love those glasses, the fake brandy glasses that look like you're going to throw it at somebody, but it's enclosed so it wouldn't come out, you know, and the melted popsicle on the floor and the vomit.
Right.
So I love making people laugh. But I was too intimidated to be singing in clubs. I thought that was too personal. And the comedy seemed to come more natural to me. So, and I'll never forget this. I was raking leaves in my yard in Connecticut. I had the radio out there. And I heard the news that Freddie Prinze had killed himself. Mm. And it was such a big, it had such an effect on the country you know, because comedy was so important. Mm-hmm. That's what I kind of realized, that comedy was so important and how much of a
because
you know,
of the way
impact.
People reacted to his death,
yeah.
and how it sort of it was a national reaction.
Yeah, huh. And before that, I just knew that, you know, comedy was great and it's great to have it, but when someone like that has made such a mark and is gone, you know, in a sick way, I thought, well, there's an opening out there now. You know, I'm going to go out there.
You're like, thank
yeah,
God.
Yeah, finally.
What took you so long?
So, I drove out there with my buddy, just telling him, let's go see California. I didn't tell him I was going to do stand-up. Because I think a lot of people, when they're going to get into stand-up, they're a little embarrassed to say they're going to become a comedian.
That happened to me when I was working on Wall Street. I was hiding it from everybody. I was literally leading a secret double life.
Yes.
It happened because I got to write, I wrote some jokes as a hobby, and I got to see Jay Leno at a private function here in New York, and I said, I don't know if you need jokes, and I handed him like a thick thing of jokes, and he took them, and then he called me the next day and said, I need jokes for the monologue for the Tonight Show. I'll hire you. I'll pay you per joke if I use it. And then he did one of my jokes the next week, and it
How great
blew
was that?
My head. And then he said to me, go try the jokes out before you send them to me. And I go, how do I do that? He goes, well, don't go to like the Improv or Catch a Rising Star. Those are big clubs. They won't let you perform there yet. Just go to dive bars, the little bars. And that's how it started. And it was that feeling of like,
great.
Holy crap, this is like cool.
Yeah, right.
You know, you have 5 minutes. You don't get a laugh for 4.5 of those. But that one laugh is
that's
like.
That's all it takes, man. That's
so you go out there, but you don't tell your friend who's in a, like, no. why? That's hilarious.
Yeah, so we ended up in San Diego. We kind of cruised through L.A. I saw the Improv. I met Bud Freeman and
there
for a little bit. And then we went down to San Diego just to check that out. And that's when I started going to like the La Jolla Comedy Club.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see two comics there. And I always got them confused because I didn't know. I couldn't remember who was who. You know, one of them had a big chin. The other one had a gap between the teeth. And it was Leno and Letterman.
Oh,
you know?
Jesus.
And I remember watching. I remember seeing Johnny Dark there.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple other comics. And I was just blown away about how good they were.
Yeah.
You know, and
now you had seen live comedy in the city in New York.
Yeah.
Right? So it wasn't your first time.
But these were full sets. You know, the Catch a Rising Star was like 15 minutes each.
They're headlining. They're doing
these are headliners. Time. So the MC would come out and he was good. And I thought, man, that guy was great. And then the middle act would come out. He would be fantastic. And then the headliner would come out. And I go, oh, my God.
I got to go back to Connecticut.
There was Johnny Dark, Kipadada, Letterman and Leno. Those are the four I remember.
Those are all heavyweights. So are you intimidated at that point? Like, maybe I can't do this? Or?
Oh, well, I will tell you that the two times I got the most intimidated was after, like, Leno would come in to the Improv and perform because he was so strong.
On Melrose?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see that and go, God, I'll never be like that, you know. And then the other time was before that, I was at a comedy club in Newport Beach going to watch, and Robin Williams was on. I never heard of him before. And he just blew me away, blew everybody away. And I thought, why am I even doing this? You know, but then I realized that he can't be everywhere at the same time, and I'll take you to places where he can't be.
And chances are he'll do a Freddie Prinze and what you ended up doing, unfortunately, but... He was a great guy. He was so sweet.
Yeah, he was.
He would hang out at the Comedy Cellar in New York and just be the most unassuming guy. Like,
he was a people pleaser.
He was very sweet. And Leno, who I've had on the show, tells the story of how he went to L.A., time slipped out of his car, just wanted to focus on stand-up. But nobody wanted to follow Richard Pryor at the Comedy Store, but he wanted to follow Pryor. And he said because Pryor would, like, destroy, apparently.
Sure, yeah.
And Leno, such a technician, like, was like, I knew that if a joke, even one of my jokes after Pryor did well, then I knew it was a really great joke. Like, it forced me to up my game.
And
I don't know if you knew him later on in the stand-up world, but he seemed to be, like, that real, like, purist when it came to the craft of it. You know?
Oh, yeah, totally. I remember flying up to Lake Tahoe with him, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Because he was the entertainer at the American Century Championship up there, golf tournament,
mm-hmm.
and I was playing in it, and I was scheduled to do his show that day, and he invited me to fly up to Tahoe with him on a little chartered Learjet or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I said okay. So we finish the show, we drive over to the airport, we get in this little jet, And he's got his index cards. He's learning the monologue for the next day on, you know, because he's going to fly back that night.
To do the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Right.
And before we leave, the pilot goes, you know, there's a lot of fires up in Lake Tahoe, so we may have to land in Reno and drive up. It's about an hour and 15-minute drive. And Jay goes, well, let's see what happens as we get closer. You know.
That's a good Jay.
I thought, oh, God. I don't like to fly in the first place, you know, especially in a small jet. I know nothing about. So we get... We're flying there, and he's in the back, kind of dozing a little bit, looking at his cards, and I start to smell a little smoke in the cabin, you know, as we're getting closer to Tahoe, and I kind of got up and walked up to the cockpit. It's a small plane, and I said, "Hey, you know, guys, if you think it's too dangerous to land in Tahoe, let's go to Reno." And Jay heard me. He's like, sleeps with one eye open, you know. He goes, "No, we'll go to Lake Tahoe. You know, I've had a full life. You know, I don't need the, you know." I said, "But Jay, I haven't had a full. I have a kid." He says, "It's my plane. I did the plane." Yeah. So we flew into Lake Tahoe through the smoke and landed. And
really?
Yeah, he did his gig and left that night, I guess.
He's so focused.
He's so focused. And
he
so,
had this one joke, because when I got to the point, I wasn't in stand-up yet. I just really liked it, and I was now working as a lawyer or whatever. But I went to see him at a, you know, his act, I don't know, it's nightclub, theater act. Really, really, just really funny. And he had this one joke. He goes, I bought some of these chicken McNuggets today. He goes, let me tell you about these chicken McNuggets. He goes, you can put a box of chicken McNuggets on the ground, open the cover. A chicken could walk up to that box, look inside, and say, I see nothing that offends me here.
I know it.
And, you know, when you immediately hear, especially as a comic, like a McDonald's joke, you think, okay, well, that's kind of a hackneyed premise to go on. But he was able to take it and make it,
yeah,
so funny, like just so, so funny and tight.
Yeah, he had a distinct style, that's for sure. I also remember when I first got to the Improv, there were the only comics that were kind of hanging out waiting to go on were Italians, Jews, you know, Irish, black comics. And now, you know, 35 years later or whatever, it's everybody, you know, it's Pakistanis, Asian, everything.
And did you start to sort of gravitate to a particular style or find your influence? Because I find sometimes, I think even with myself, like you kind of initially get influenced by a certain style or type, and then you have to kind of work your way out of that to find your own voice. Or did you immediately seem to find your voice?
No, I think you're right. You're influenced by somebody, and so it's like being a trainee on a job. You know, you emulate the person that you're working with. And it takes a while to find your own style. I don't think anybody has that confidence or trust to develop a style right away on stage. When I was starting off, you see a lot of people doing Letterman or Woody Allen, you know, or Richard Pryor types or Steve Martin. And I was influenced by, you know, a lot of people. I grew up watching Jerry Lewis movies and you know, all those jokes in the back of the parade section, Stanley Meyer and Handelman, Ronnie Dangerfield, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, before I went out there, I was mostly influenced by Andy Kaufman and Albert Brooks and Steve Martin, because they were so unique and original. Mm. They weren't like all the other comics.
Yeah.
And I love that about them, because I think comedy is kind of verbal misdirection magic. It's like verbal magic a little bit, you know. And
I see a lot of in your acting, like Mrs. Subliminal.
Yeah.
Did that come... For those of you who don't know, and you need to just go on YouTube and see it. I just as a fan and also a comedian, how you came up with that character, it is so funny and so smart.
Well, thank you. That kind of taught me to keep my eyes open. When you're a comic, people ask how you come up with your material, and it's, obviously there's many different ways, you know. But I think just kind of being aware all the time and kind of reading and listening and watching things. But for that particular character, I used to do it in my act. I would do a thing called tagging in my act before I got to SNL.
Yeah.
And I got that from, I didn't actually come up with that. That was a guy named Ed Peck, a character actor, who used to do shows like Laverne and Shirley, who always played the cops or Happy Days.
Oh, okay.
And he was a big guy with a deep voice, you know, and he was a big fan of mine. You know, he hung out at the Improv, and I used to bartend there for 2 years, and I'd just be there all the time. And he grew fond of me. And one night he goes, hey, let's go to Kenner's. I'm going to show you a little thing I'm going to do with a waitress here. So he called it tagging. And he would slip in, he wouldn't try to get somebody to do something for him. He would just like to slip in words like, you know, he'd be ordering. He goes, oh, let's see, darling, I think I'm going to have the ham sandwich, whore. And now, why don't you also give me some French fries, your treat? And, you know, he would be real, real, really profane with the waitress, you know. So when I got to Saturday Night Live, That was like the first thing I did. The first sketch I did was Mr. Subliminal.
Yeah.
And I wrote that with Al Franken.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I used to go to school for marketing, so I knew about subliminal advertising.
Right.
And incorporating that. So we kind of mixed the two of them together.
And did you, it's funny because when you were on SNL, you say Lorne Michaels came up to you and said, "Are you sure this is what you want?" He meant, "Are you sure you want fame, popularity?" And you say, "I knew it was what I wanted." And he said that to you on the first night?
Well, right before I was about to go on and do the subliminal sketch, which took a lot of focus because it's like two conversations going on at once. And I'm really concentrating. It's my first time on SNL. And I guess it's his way of kind of, you know, being funny and reassuring you, you know. He put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Are you sure this is what you want?"
And you're already probably freaking out live national television.
Yeah,
right?
But I think he did that to kind of reassure me and also to make me less nervous.
Yeah.
You know, just saying, "Hey, this is fun. You know, this is,
it's
a big show. Are you sure you can handle it?"
Yeah.
You know, kind of kiddingly.
Do you remember the first couple, and if you don't want to do it, but I just want people to hear one or two. Do you remember the first, like in the first sketch, some of the stuff that you would do, some of the lines from the Civil
War? Yeah. It was with John Lovitz and Victoria Jackson, and it was an advertising agency. And, I would go up to Victoria Jackson. She was a receptionist, and I would say things like, "Hey, it's really nice to see you. You know, we should go out to dinner sometime. You're a treat, you know, and have a good time." And you know, and then I go into John Lovitz's office. He was the boss, and he would commend me on, I think, on something I did well. I go, "Oh, that's awful nice of you, sir. Mets tickets. I don't know. I enjoy being here. I'll tell you what. Why don't I give you some Mets tickets?" "Oh, that's awful nice. You know." So it's things like that.
Did you?
So, there's Hot Sex was another one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So writing on a staff, first of all, that a lot of people say that class, if you will, around 86, 87, with the list of people that I mentioned and others coming in and out, and Adam Sandler comes into that grouping while you're there, and kind of saved Saturday Night Live in a way. It kind of had hit a wall or was in a transition period. Dana Carvey came in. I think Dana knew you and recommended you, right? You knew him from the L.A. scene, the San Francisco scene?
I knew him from the San Francisco scene and L.A. He would come down, and also he started renting the room above the garage in a house I lived in Hollywood, in Hollywood Hills. And Spade would eventually sublet my room when I went off to do SNL.
Wow.
You know, and then he got it. But, yeah, I was dating Jan Hooks at the time, and Dana was living over the garage. He had gotten Saturday Night Live. So he went there that summer of 86, and Jan was up for it. And I was excited for both of them. I was reading Backstage Live at SNL. Very excited. I never thought I would ever have an opportunity to be on that show. I didn't even think I'd be good for it because I was a stand-up. You know, I didn't do characters or sketches. And then Dana calls me from one day in the summer. He goes, "Hey, Kev, I'm at Lorne Michaels' house. I'm in the back bedroom. Guess who's in the kitchen? Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd." I said, "Are you kidding me?" He goes, "No. I told Lorne about you. I think they're looking for one more cast member. And so they might want to see your tapes." And I said, "What, Chevy Chase is in the kitchen? Oh, with Dan Aykroyd? Oh, my God." And then, you know, I didn't really think anything of it, but I thought, you know, I'll never be good on that show. So I sent him my tapes, and 2 weeks later, I get another call.
Kev, hang on, back up for 1 second. Now you have to, if you want to, just the first step of the process is three original characters, and you have to present them with two impressions.
I don't remember what the
characters? Or just your
stand-up? I don't remember. I just went in there and I did, I think, whatever I had.
Wow.
And okay, Dana and I used to mess around in the driveway of the house we lived in, just kind of, you know, improvising characters. So I had a couple of, like, characters. We did couple of Sammys. We did two guys who always like boasted about what they were going to do. Like, "You know what I want to do, Sammy?" They were both named Sammy. To this day, Dennis Miller calls me Sammy. "You know what I want to do, Sammy?" "What do you want to do, Sammy?" We'd be eating Chinese takeout food, you know, just real slouches. "One day I want to build a boat and I want to sail around the world and I want to, whoa, am I kidding? That's another thing I'm never going to do. Give me some of that Tim Squat sum soup." You know, and it would go on like that. It was like the same set like as a Wayne World.
So I didn't mean to. So you're saying Chevy's in the kitchen.
I said, "Wow, Chevy's in the kitchen. Wow." And then 2 weeks later, he calls me back. "Kev, I'm back out at Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen? I think they like your tapes. Guess who's in the kitchen? It's Steve Martin and Paul Simon. You're kidding me? No. I think they like your. I think Lorne likes your tapes. I think they'll fly in for an audition. Steve Martin's in the kitchen.
That's all you care about."
So I fly in for an audition, knowing I'll never get it. I just enjoyed the trip to New York. Everybody else is nervous. The plane is full of people, like, going to audition for that one role. You know, even the pilot comes out of the cockpit. Hey, you guys think this is funny? You know, I'm going to do this.
Bring it over the speaker.
Yeah. The whole way we had to hear his act.
We're 20 minutes from touchdown, but before I do that, let me run this by you.
So I get to New York, and I'm, you know, I go to Studio 8H, 30 Rock. And
you're truly not nervous?
Not nervous. No,
because
I'm not
going
to get it. I'm a little intimidated to meet Lorne Michaels, you know.
Now, at that point, it's either people coming out of True Improv,
Second City Groundlings
or
yeah.
like somebody like Dana, who I would imagine, I don't think he has that training,
no.
but has a lot of impressions
characters,
and
yeah.
characters,
yeah.
right? And you're kind of just straight
I'm a straight stand-up, except for the couple characters Dana and I used to do in the driveway, you know. So I go in and I audition for them, you know, right on the floor in front of at the end of the bleachers, I remember that, in front of a camera, and they're all sitting there, Lorne and A. Whitney Brown and Dana and Nora Dunn and John Lovitz, you know, all the cast members that they had at that point. And I finished my audition. I thought, okay, this is a fun trip to New York. You know, everybody else is sweating and worried. And I go back to L.A. and 2 weeks later, I'm meeting in front of Lorne, and he's offered me a job at SNL.
Wow.
And I said, well, let me think about it over the weekend.
No,
I did say that.
Did you really?
He goes, well, you think about it over the weekend and we'll see you in New York on Monday. He saw right through
me. Really?
So 2 weeks later,
What was that? I'm going to think about it. You're just playing coy, like whatever?
Well, my manager said, let's kind of like, you know, jump out, you know.
Now, what did you do in the audition? Did you do some characters? Or just
I did the couple of Sammy's character, and then I did another one. These two porno stars sitting in a makeup chair while they're getting fluffed, and you know, and we're just talking about, you know, just kind of normal stuff, like, you know, what are you going to do later on today, Jack? Well, I think, you know, I might go. And then we keep making comments to the makeup artist, like, hey, put some pinstripes in that, you know, make it a little bit nice for the people. It's always for the people. You know, give me a little fluff, a little sparkle for the people. So, you know, I got back from the store yesterday, Tommy, and I, yeah, that's it. Yeah, put some glitter on the tip, just on the top of it over there. And so next thing I know, I'm at Lorne Michaels' house, and I got a call from Dana Carvey, you know, 2 weeks later. He goes, Kev, I'm in the back bedroom. I said, I know, I'm in the kitchen.
That's awesome. That's so great. And you were a feature player, and you said, and then you also were maybe a guest star on Weeds, whatever, but you said, it's always interesting because no one really commits to me in the beginning. It was the same thing with Weeds. I was a guest star in the pilot. They didn't hire me as a regular until the show got picked up. Why is that? Why are you an acquired, I don't know, maybe that means you're an acquired taste in your mind. What do you think that's about?
That's a good question. I think that maybe I'm not on somebody's mind in the beginning, and then when they have these last characters that they need, and maybe it's the timing. Mm. They just happen to see me on something, and then they bring me in. But then it's more of a test run for me, because maybe I present myself as unsure. Maybe they're not sure that I'm talented or anything, you know. So we'll give them a try.
It's you don't come off as a super pushy person. So like, I mean, there are some performers and people in this business in front of them and behind the camera that are very much like kind of draw the attention to themselves.
Yeah, yeah,
and maybe maybe that's part of it. But obviously your talent.
I'm like a foster dog. You know, they'll take me in for like a week and see if it works out.
You didn't shit on the rug.
Well, actually I did.
But it was in Lorne Michaels' kitchen.
It was in his kitchen.
Right next to Paul Simon's crap.
Yeah.
So now you're
a big pile of crap in the kitchen.
Hey, I'm shitting next to Paul Simon.
I'm adding to the celebrity crap pile.
So now you're on the staff, starting as a feature player.
Yes, I'm a feature player and a writer.
And then become a cast member. So tell me, and I've always been fascinated, because there was a lot of, when I was writing full-time on The Daily Show, there was a healthy but sometimes dysfunctional competition among the writers to get stuff on and to not necessarily always be supportive. I know, and I've heard, like, at SNL, it can be competitive. Also, over time, certain writers tend to gravitate and work more regularly with certain performers.
Yeah.
And you're a very nice human being that can be kind of a lion's pit, if you will. I think any show in writing, and you know, very type A personalities. How was it there, and how did you cope with that kind of environment, if it was anything like that?
When you first come onto the show, you try to form an alliance, and you find out who has your sensibilities as far as comedy, and who likes you and understands your sense of humor. I was hired as a writer first, so I was supposed to be writing, basically, and they guaranteed me 7 spots on the show for the year as a feature player.
Oh.
Like, you know, in a sketch or something.
Yeah.
So basically, I wrote for myself, but added other you know, cast members in my sketches.
And who did you feel, Lovitz, was that one? Who did you feel kind of you your sensibility?
Well, writing-wise, I kind of connected with Dana, because we came up with the Hans and Franz characters, you know. And but I think I used everybody. You know, Jan Hooks was really, I thought she was such a special performer and so talented, effortlessly, too. Mm. You know, I never even saw her, like, spend hours rehearsing on anything, you know. She just kind of came to her. But so Dana and I kind of, we shared an office too for the first year or two. So we kind of wrote a lot and together. And then when I got on Weekend Update, it was hard to get people to write for Weekend Update because on Monday, nobody's asking, hey, who came up with that Clinton joke, you know, at the water cooler? You know, it's more about sketches. Hey, did you see that character on SNL last night? So they would entice people to come up to the 17th floor, the writing floor, you know, the offices were on Saturday morning, to the writer's room, and they would spread out AP photos. There was no internet back then, no Google. So they'd spread out the Associated Press photos everywhere and also dunk newspapers, and they'd have it catered with a breakfast, hot breakfast, to get the writers to come up. So the only people that really would come up with new writers who weren't that good, and Al Franken would come up and he would write because he loves politics.
Yeah.
And some people would come up just to have breakfast and read the paper. You know? So I had to like find people in Los Angeles and around to send me in jokes.
Are you serious?
And I would pay them out of my pocket.
Because
like
now
bucks.
They have specific staffers assigned to write that segment.
I think I started that. So I would hire people, you know, I would pay, just like Leno did with you, I would pay them like $50 a joke. And I wouldn't start writing until like Friday because all the other late night hosts had done those topical jokes before then.
Yeah.
So I would write myself. I'd get maybe five or six jokes in, and then, you know, Herb Sargent was the segment producer and he'd write some jokes. And then I get some from Al Franken and Jim Downey, and some, you know, sporadic writers would come up with stuff. But after I think a year or two of me paying people, Lauren decided to get me a full-time writer, one writer to write, you know.
It's better than nothing, right?
Yeah, so that was good.
What was it about the show that they saw in you that you could do that? You were great at it.
I think Lauren always had his eye on me as a Weekend Update guy.
Really?
Yeah. Dennis did it great, and people loved Dennis, but I guess Dennis eventually wanted to move on. But I loved the way Chevy Chase, my thing, I was trying to emulate Chevy Chase more, because I loved the way Chevy Chase did it.
She was on the phone at the beginning?
Yeah.
No, I like it when you do that. And I do see that sort of sensibility there in that part of what you do.
But that's the great thing about Weekend Update. It's almost like being a president. Everybody has a different kind of a personality and a different way of doing it.
It's such an iconic segment and position. Did that influence you? Did that affect you at all? Were you intimidated when
you
first sat
down? Well, it was a little
down?
Intimidating because I knew it was that pivotal point in the show. It was like, it was the anchor part of the show. You know, because I think the band came on like right before Weekend Update. And it was a nice thing. It was a sit-down job. You know, you wouldn't have to be running around getting dressed. That was the other thing, too. I had to do sketches as well. I wasn't just doing Weekend Update.
Right.
Dennis mostly just did Weekend Update, and he was very good at it. And he really, that's what he aspired to. He loved the
He didn't want to do sketches? He wasn't.
He wrote a sketch called Coco and LeBay or something like that. I forget the name. He'd kill me if I forgot the name of it. But it was a really, real surreal kind of writing.
Yeah.
Like a fantasy thing with three characters, me, Dana, and Dennis, kind of prancing through the countryside, dressed up as clowns and different outfits. And so he did that one. But mostly he was just doing Weekend Update. So, you know, like I had to focus on writing sketches and characters and doing stuff like that, and also doing Weekend Update, making sure that the jokes were there.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't focus on Weekend Update as much as I would have liked to.
Right.
But it was still fun, and I enjoyed doing it.
Were you responsible in that position for also overseeing and signing off on any of the bits at the desk with you by the other players? So, like, you know, our special correspondent, Adam Sandler, like, who was sort of the final arbiter of those pieces?
Well, Lauren is always the final arbiter, but I had a lot to do with it. And a lot of times, though, I didn't have the time to focus on that because, like I said, I was doing other things. And there's so many people want to be on Weekend Update. And I'm like, I hate to tell people no.
Yeah.
So Lauren would usually kind of weigh in and say who was going to be on. I guess he was the final arbiter. Yeah. But yeah, it was fun. It was a fun job.
Do you, how was it as a writer not to want to go get and sort of align yourself with the biggest star on the show and try to write for them because you see, like, that's maybe your meal ticket to the next. Was there any
temptation? I never thought about that, no. Mm-hmm. I never thought about that. My goal was to stay in that show as long as possible because I knew it was a great gig.
Yeah.
You know, you hear about people going on there and being frustrated and angry and, you know, the competitiveness, and the boys club or whatever. But I recognized it as being a great job, especially for me because, you know, I could think of a billion people that would be much better at it than I was, you know.
I don't know about that. I think, what is it that people don't know that Lauren Michaels, even people like myself who are work in this business, don't know about Lauren Michaels in terms of his true, I mean, he's got many talents, I'm sure, but is it his ability to spot talent initially? Is it ability to spot talent and then foster it and sort of cultivate it? Like, what is it that...
Well, he definitely has the tools to cultivate a comic.
Yeah.
He has all of the programs and the spots, but I think he has a way, whether it's picking talent or picking a staff to find, to call the talent, bring in like a big group, and then he handpicks the ones, you know, after seeing them, it's a talent for sure. But I think a lot of people don't know how generous he is and funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a writer on the credits, but he doesn't sit in a room like most of the writers and write all night. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, he will add things, or you go to him and he go, I think we need to cut this part and do this, you know.
Which amazes me because the other night, it was a few weeks ago, you know, they were, you know how they'll, they're in the middle of the show and then they'll, in between two commercials, they'll go back to the show as it's setting up for the next sketch. And standing in front of that set, in his suit, his hands in his pocket, is Lauren Michaels looking around. And I'm like, man, this guy, like, is the probably most powerful guy in television. And not in terms of an executive that runs a network, but in terms of a producer, creator. And he's still, like, literally on the ground with stage hands next to him. Like,
yeah, no, he loves that. And that's part of the show, too. That's kind of planned to have him in that shot.
Oh.
To let, you know, because he is a part of that show.
Yeah.
And he likes being in sketches too, in the cold openings.
Yeah.
They say a surefire way to get a sketch on is to either have Lauren in it or the host. You know?
Did you ever have anything that you really fought for that he felt was crossing the line, or?
I never had anything that was really crossing the line that I could remember. But there were things that I thought were funny that should have been put on Lauren, and everybody had that too. Everybody had that. And as a producer, like Lauren, you know, you can't please everybody.
Mm.
You know, you're kind of making decisions based on what you think is going to work, and from your experience.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating for, you know, a player, a comedy player, to, you know, not have that kind of control. Which is why I like the idea of doing my own movie. You know, the pleaser movie.
Yeah.
Because you do have that control in that. Final cut and edit, and sometimes it turns out better with you at the reins.
Where did you're a really good actor.
Thank you. Good
in Weeds. What did you train a lot? Because I know some stand-ups fall into the trap of thinking, well, I'm a stand-up, I'm a performer, I can act, and it's a completely different discipline. Because as a stand-up, you need to be listening to the audience, and you can't do that when you're acting and all of that.
Right. Well, you know, we're talking about being embarrassed to say you wanted to be a stand-up, you know, to get into comedy. It was the same for me for acting. I was doing stand-up at the Improv, and Mark Lanau, which was Bud Partners at the time.
He used to manage up until recently Lewis Black.
Did he? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he kind of came up to me and said, and he was an actor at the time, too. He goes, you ever think about acting? And I said, no, I was kind of embarrassed even if I could acknowledge that.
Yeah.
He goes, no, not really. He goes, you got to take some acting workshops, because a lot of times when you're doing stand-up, they'll have casting people come into the room and want you to come in for a cold reading for like one of their pilots that are coming up. So I started taking acting workshops around Los Angeles for years, and it was really helpful. I'm glad I did that.
Yeah,
I think if you're a comic and you don't get into that, I mean, if you don't want to be an actor, that's fine. But if you think you might want to do that, it's a great way to do it, because you don't want to be working on the road in your 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and I think in terms of a discipline, there's this tendency, if you're a comic, I think we naturally bifurcate our minds, and we're doing our act, but we're also listening to how the audience is reacting and maybe adjusting. And when I'm in a scene with you, I have to be in the scene with you 100%. I can't be floating outside of it going, how is this going right now?
Yeah.
And so I found in sort of doing acting training that it helped me to kind of, you know, say, okay, I'm going to shut the door on that stand-up part of me, and it's this now, and I got to be in this moment. And do you find that the pleaser, the way you've written it, is going to be obviously comedic, but sort of have some sort of more revealing, serious moments too about?
Oh yeah, there's definitely an emotional slant to it. I think the heart tugging. I think that's the way comedy works the best. You know, yeah. You can't be all funny.
Yeah,
you've got to
yeah.
have some serious moments.
Yeah.
And then I remember watching Steel Magnolias once, and there was a moment where all the ladies were walking and sad about something, and somebody said something that this fused the whole thing, and everyone started laughing. And I thought it was so funny, and
yeah.
it was such a relief from that stress of the pain of what was going on.
Yeah.
And I knew how important that was for comedy.
Yeah.
It's just like in the final scene of Weeds, you know, we're all sitting on the porch, mm-hmm. and it's snowing out, and we're all, you know, passing up joint around, and it's kind of a somber moment. And then Jenji Cohen said for me to whisper a joke into Mary Louise's ear, you know, and didn't tell her, said, don't tell her what you're going to do, you know. And so I did that, and everybody started laughing, and it kind of diffused that whole
yeah.
moment, and it showed that we're going to all be all right.
Yeah.
And we're going to go on.
So a sense of hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What does your wife do for you? My wife, for me, is not in this business, a museum person, works in a museum, sort of is. She's just a good.
When you say museum person, do you mean she's a dinosaur?
She's a dinosaur. She is a. She actually, I'm going to give you a ticket. You can get in free. She's on display today at the Museum of Natural History. No, historic costumes and clothing from the 18th and 19th century. That's
wow.
her thing. So she had, but her job, they don't pay anything, and no one ever leaves those jobs, like a curator, an archivist. So like you do that out of love. So
yeah.
It's not an easy job to get and then keep and whatever. And she's, but
she'd be a good stylist for like movies from period pieces.
Well, you go to a movie with her and she'll be like,
that's wrong.
Totally wrong.
Yeah. Wow.
She gets mad.
Wow.
Like she goes, that dress, this is how detailed it is. She goes, that dress would not have that collar in 1862.
That's
like,
cool.
It's like, and she had one of the coolest jobs, I think, to this day. We both grew up in Rhode Island. We went to high school together. And she ended up going back up to New England for a little while and worked at the Society for the Preservation of New England Antiquities. And she got to oversee the Revolutionary War clothing that these guys actually wore during the Revolutionary
wow.
War. She had to handle it with gloves. And
right.
She and I took one of the jackets and wore it out. And got spaghetti on. I'm like, well, it's
spaghetti.
Red.
I haven't heard the word spaghetti in a long time.
Spaghetti. And by yeah. the way, Italians call it gravy, not sauce.
Like, really?
Yeah, they call it gravy. There's two
that.
Kinds. You got to just like yeah. If you're with some
gravy.
Italian people and you call it really Italian people, you call it gravy. They will buy you
That's
a Camaro.
Right. I got to remember that. The Camaro.
But she's sort of she, you know, and you get coming out of Wall Street, I was used to a world where it was like, go, go, go. I did M&A deals. So it was like, get them done, move to the next thing.
Yeah.
Very straightforward. And this is a business, as you know, that's very subjective. Things don't always happen at a time frame that people say it's going to.
Right.
And so she's been a good sort of calming influence. Is your wife that way too? Or how does she compliment you? Or how do you guys?
My wife is also she's a comedian. She's not a stand-up, but she's a comedic actress.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really funny, and she's got a really good sensibility when it comes to what works and what
yeah.
doesn't work, especially for me.
Yeah.
Although sometimes she'll think something won't work, and I like to prove her wrong, you know. But she's a great actress. She's funny. She's had a recurring role on Parks and Rec. She played Jessica Wicks.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
And then she just finished shooting a Christopher Guest movie, the new one called Mascots, where she's...
Tell people who she is.
Yeah, Susan Yankley, her name is, and she's got a big role in it. She plays Parker Posey's sister.
Oh, wow.
And they're just throughout the movie, and she's really excited about it. That'll be out in the summer. But I met her... I was going to do a talk show pilot for my friend John Henson, and I was one of the guests, along with Ray Romano and Kevin James. And I got there a little bit late because I was doing my own show at the time. And they were running behind, as they always do, on those types of shows. And Susan was sitting in the makeup room in the chair. She seemed very bored. She was a comedic fashion correspondent for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw her, and I thought she was really cute. I wasn't dating anybody at the time. I hadn't dated for a while. And I go to my makeup artist a couple seats away, loud enough for her to hear. I say, you know, you hear about a lot of you know, single women actresses adopting a kid. Can a single guy adopt a kid? And she kind of perked up. And, you know, I didn't really plan it to be a pickup line, but it was really, for me at the time, it was the best pickup line ever.
Yeah,
because it showed her that I, you know, was available and I wanted a kid.
And of course, it was all whatever.
Yeah, so we hung out and talked. We had a good time. We laughed. And then we ended up getting married.
That's great. So you've been an animal rights activist, and I'm fascinated by this episode in your life where Ringling Brothers was sort of hired private detectives and was wiretapping animal rights activists and all that, and you kind of got...
I had heard about that. You know, that's like the second time I've been... apparently, I don't know whether I was wiretapped or what, but checked out. You know, once was with Pelicano for that case out in Los Angeles. Had nothing to do with Ringling Brothers. And another one was the Ringling Brothers because I was protesting out front, you know, trying to keep people away from coming to see the circus because of the way the animals have to live in that life, you know.
Right.
And but yeah, I'd heard that, but I don't. That's all I know. I only know what I read.
Do you still do a lot in that? I mean, I know on your site you have links to PETA and all of that. And,
yeah.
Is it getting better? I mean, is that?
It is getting better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot less animal testing going on now. There's well, unfortunately, I still see fur out there a lot. You know, people don't kind of put
especially
it together.
Especially in New York. Like
unless it's faux fur, because the faux fur is looking really good these days.
Yeah. You know? You look good in it right now.
Yeah. You know, it's faux fur and it's also faux cotton.
You feel bad for the plants?
Yeah.
And do you, but that sounds like it's a life sort of commitment for
you. You know, I'm not as involved as I used to be. My wife used to be an animal activist, my ex-wife.
Yeah.
And so I kind of got more drawn into it back then. And I read up on factory farming and slaughterhouses. So for me, it's kind of a health thing and also ethical.
Yeah.
But I don't really force it on other people, you know, because I'm, like I said, I'm confrontational adverse.
Yeah. Which is funny.
But for me, it works.
But it's funny being a stand-up. What do you do? What did you do with hecklers in the day? Being given the nature of who you are, I mean, you're so nice.
Well, I never really got a lot of hecklers.
Yeah.
The only hecklers that you get really are drunk people.
Yes.
Who are obnoxious.
Yeah.
And usually they throw them out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a couple of standard lines, you know, for them. And but now it's... I've heard a lot that my comedy is deceptive. You know, it's not... It sneaks up on you.
Yes.
So I think people are typically afraid to heckle because they're not sure what I'm carrying.
When did you figure out that was your voice?
It takes a long time. You know, it takes a long time. It's like being a blues musician. You have to live life and you've got to perform a lot to really kind of find out what your voice is. And, you know, I'm still evolving. I'm still trying to find what the next thing is about me. It's just like being a person. You know, whatever you do, you're kind of always changing and growing.
I mean, I would imagine you have one child.
One child, pretty sure.
How old is he now?
He's eight, almost nine.
So I started around that age talking about his age, that when he was that age, talking about him and whatever. Are you comfortable talking about that stuff?
Is it too personal? I hadn't been for a long time.
Because you wanted to keep it a little private.
Yeah. Not even private, but, you know, I find that one club owner once told me, you know, when you start talking about your kid, it's kind of, you know, you start losing, you know, audience members. But I didn't agree with that. But also, I guess maybe it was a little bit of a privacy thing. And but he is such a big part of my life. He's the center of my life. So it's really something I have been starting to talk about more and more lately.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of impossible not to because, you know, even sort of the way I behave sometimes, like if he's around, you know, you got to sort of watch how you behave. It's sort of.
Yeah, sort of.
You know, like if I lose my thing. And you don't mind. I know, like, you like to be home with him from what I've read. And, but you're also going to go out. You're going to work with Norm Macdonald, which must be fun. January 22nd, you and he are going to be at the Lincoln Center in Fort Collins, Colorado. I was just there in Denver at the Improv. I had a great time. And on January 23rd, you're going to be at the Wild Horse Pass Casino Hotel in Chandler, Arizona. So is something you've done? Have you worked with Norm before?
I have. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, when you go out as a stand-up alone, as a headliner, it gets, you know, a little boring.
Yeah.
But it's what I do. I'm kind of used to it. You know, I do when I get to a hotel. I like to, you know, get some work done, write a little bit, maybe go see a movie.
Yeah.
You know, you have your things you do. But when you go out with someone like Norm, it becomes a whole nother ball game because all of a sudden it's like you're on vacation with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and you're having fun. Yeah. And you're sharing stories. And
you end up in the casino because he likes the game.
Well, he doesn't gamble anymore, but he's just, you know, everybody's got their idiosyncrasies, and it's always entertaining to be with somebody for that long and seeing, you know, how great they are or what a hot mess they are, you know.
I was just saying that in Denver, like, as a comic, you kind of get dropped into a very intense relationship with people over the course of like 4 days, and then you go, like, right, like the staff, like you're around the you're only on stage for 45 minutes an hour per show, so it's 2 hours a night if you're doing two shows, and the rest of the day it's you're doing press or you're with all these people at this club who you've just met, and so you there's this weird kind of closeness that happens over a very short period of time, and then it's gone, and then you're on. And
the same with a movie too, when you're working on a movie.
Yeah.
Probably even more so because maybe it's a couple of months.
Yeah.
And you are like that family, and then everybody's gone.
Would you get fidgety on the set? Because I just did something on a movie. You get a lot of sitting around waiting, as they say, and being a stand-up in the immediacy of being able to write and then go tell your joke that night. How would you kind of keep yourself in the flow and in the moment so that you didn't get frustrated or stale? Because there's a lot of sitting around and waiting.
Yeah, the waiting is the hard part. It's like golf. You know, if you have to wait for the group in front of you to tee off, you kind of lose your momentum.
Yeah.
But with stand-up, and it's even like performing a lot. I used to have to look at my notes a lot before I went on because I wasn't performing that much. Mm. But then as I realized that if you're performing almost every weekend, you don't even need your notes, and you're creating new stuff all the time.
Yeah. Do you follow the same order with your stuff, or you mix it up?
No, I mix it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were just at Caroline's this past weekend, and with Louis Franda. How's it going?
Louis is great. Louis, I first met him at the Catch a Rising Star.
Yeah.
It's a good impression.
Yeah.
How you doing, Kevin?
Yeah. A lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Louis is, for people listening, is one of sort of the, and behind the scenes, one of the bigger names, because the Booker who discovered big people like you
real
mentioned.
Real aficionado of comedy.
Richard, yeah. And Richard, and then moved on to book Caroline's for the last, I don't know, 15 years or whatever, and a real character. Just as we wrap up, so you did Roxanne with Steve Martin. Was that a bit surreal for you? You know, you did your first Tonight Show in 1984 after only being in L.A. a couple of years. That was pretty good.
Well, yeah, after I got to L.A. in 78, around there.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, was that long? Oh, then it's not
it's not so much of an accomplishment. but yeah, Roxanne was great. I mean, I was a huge fan of Steve Martin's, and to get into this film was great, and to hang out in British Columbia and Nelson, we shot that in Nelson, British Columbia for 3 weeks. Rich Scheidner and I were in it. We played Drunks Number 1 and 2, and they had a lot of comics in that movie too. Damon Wayans was in it.
Oh, really?
Steve Middleman.
Oh,
yeah. A couple other comics.
Did you know Ronnie Shakes?
I saw him at the Catch the Rising Star a few times. God, I saw him in the bar, but I never really
I
got
saw
to
him
know.
On the Tonight Show a few times. He was so funny.
Yeah, he was great.
I showed my son his act the other night on YouTube.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know why that came
there
were
some
mind.
Really great comics that we lost over the years.
Yeah.
Dennis,
what's
his name? Wolfberg. Dennis Wolfberg was a great comic,
he
too.
He started at the comic strip. His picture's up there. Yeah, that's still going.
His son came to one of my shows a year or so ago and introduced himself.
Is that right?
And I told him how much I enjoyed Dennis.
He has some killer sets on The Tonight Show. Dennis did,
It's always kind of weird when you have, you know, children of people that are deceased now.
Yeah.
That didn't really know them as well as you did back then. It's like Phil Hartman, his daughter, came to see a show I was doing with Dana and Dennis in Iowa a couple years ago. And we got together afterwards, and we were just telling her stories about her dad, and she was so lighting up and enjoying it.
Oh, that's nice.
Because she never hears, you know, she just gloms onto anything she can get, you know, history-wise about him.
Did you guys feel that pressure of any kind in your class, you went in 86, that you needed to kind of help rejuvenate this franchise because it had kind of...
Yeah, well, I don't know if we kind of thought that. We knew that we were being hired on the show, that they had dismal ratings the year before, and they were close to pulling the plug on the show.
Yeah, Ebersole came in for a couple of years, but then he left and Lauren came
There was
came
Gene
back.
Domanian, and then there was Ebersole, I guess. I'm not sure what the order was, but... So there were, and the year before us, it was really good actors like, you know,
Was it Robert Downey Jr.?
Robert Downey Jr., yeah, was on it.
Was Janine Garofalo?
No, she was on when I was on for a year, I think. Mm-hmm. And Anthony Michael Hall, Julie Louise Dreyfus, was on one of the things. But anyway, so we all came on. We were living out of our suitcase every week because we weren't sure if they were going to pull the plug on the show.
Really?
And eventually the ratings came up. The chemistry was right with our cast and with the writers. Yeah. Everything, that synergy has to be there.
But you didn't feel like, to me, like, it's stressful enough. I'm now a cast member on an iconic show. And then on top of that, you layer this sort of like, man, this thing could sort of crap out at any moment. There was no pressure for that or tension
because it helped. Because when you're on stage, even with stand-up, if you're doing a big show or whatever, you know, a TV show, talk show, you have incredible mind games you play to make yourself feel relaxed. And for me on SNL, my whole thing to keep from getting nervous, because I'm on the stage where John Belushi was, and it's Saturday Night Live, and 30 Rock, and Lorne Michaels, and you know, the band's playing. I convinced myself that nobody watches the show anymore. The ratings were so low the year before. No one's going to see this. The only people that are going to see it are the people in the room, and I'm used to doing stand-up, you know, and
who cares? It can't get any worse.
Yeah,
the ratings are already in the toilet.
Yeah. It's like when
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
just like when I auditioned for the show. I convinced myself that I'd never get it. You know, just have a good time.
I wanted to ask you that because it took me a while to get comfortable with when my stand-up show mattered, my set mattered, meaning like there's someone in the back assessing me for an audition for whatever. And to not give some of that power away to that, you know.
Yeah.
How did you... I would assume early on that would affect you a little bit in the room, but then how did you sort of, or maybe not, but how did you, in a stand-up club, when you were being auditioned by somebody for something, not let that affect you?
Well, here's how I learned not to let that affect me. Mm. I would audition to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, like maybe 3 times, and trying to do what I thought would be right for The Tonight Show. And Jim McCauley was a talent coordinator at the time, and I would never pass it. I was really auditioning too soon. I didn't have more than 15 minutes of material, you know, 20 maybe. And
you got to do like 6 or 7 minutes for them, right?
Yeah.
And
that's the show to be on. That's the, it validates you as a comic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like passing your bar exam.
Yeah.
And so after like 3 auditions, Jim McCauley calls my manager and says, we'd like to have Kevin come in and audition for a Michael Nesmith show. He used to be with the Monkees, you know.
Oh, right.
So he was becoming a producer.
See the one with the hat? He always wore a hat.
Yeah, the beanie, the wool cap. Yeah. So I thought, well, I'm just going to do what I think is funny this time. So I did this thing called Choices, you know, Would You Rather Or, which is a big bit I had back in the 80s, you know, which got me on The Tonight Show. And so I auditioned for Michael Nesmith, and I did that. And Jim McCauley calls me the next day. He goes, well, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is I don't think you're right for the Michael Nesmith show. The good news is we'd love to have you on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
From that set?
From that, yeah. From doing what I thought was funny.
Now, for the Nesmith show, was McCauley in the audience?
Yeah.
So you knew he was there?
He was a talent winner for that show.
Okay, but did you feel less pressure because it's not The Tonight Show, it's the Nesmith show, and it's like, whatever. Like,
there is no show yet. You know, we don't know what the Nesmith show is, so it didn't matter to me. So I did. That's when I realized, just do what I think is funny.
You can't create a set that you think they want.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could tone it down a little bit or tone it to a certain way.
But you can't start sort of trying to muscle in. You know, if they're hiring non sequitur comics like Stephen Wright or whatever, and you try to start being that, it's not true to who you are.
Yeah. Somebody told, I think it was Mel Brooks or somebody told a comic friend of mine. He said, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. People will find you. Don't try to reach those people and make them happy. You know, do what you do, and that ripple effect will bring in the people.
But with something like The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, that's got to be hard to do. And even today with big shows on the late night landscape, because it's so important to be on that show, how do you not go, I'll just muscle a set that'll kind of be what I think they want, which is, I know, the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, you do have to follow some parameters.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be dirty on the show.
Yeah.
I remember I came out there, my second time out there, my leadoff joke, they garbled because it was inappropriate for the show. And afterwards, Jim McCauley said, what was that line? I didn't know you were doing that line. I said, yeah, that's what I did in the room. He must have been talking to somebody or he didn't see it.
Oh, wow.
And it was, the line was, I'm getting ready for the end of the holidays, I've been doing a lot of drinking and driving, you know. And I didn't know Johnny Carson, like, had, you know, a drinking thing, and he had some DUI or something, you know. And I can't remember if I That's ever awesome. Did the Tonight Show again with him after that. I don't remember.
Wow.
I think I did, but still it was, you know, so there are some parameters you have to
kind of... So you take all of that with you, just to kind of sum up here, you... Whether it was performing on SNL, and I would imagine even maybe not to this day, you're so seasoned now and such a veteran, do what you want to do for you and don't make the stakes as high as they might be in your mind, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, don't sweat the small stuff, and just, you know, do what you do and trust. You got to trust yourself.
And do you believe Mel Brooks when he says it comes to you, the audience finds you?
Yeah.
Your right audience finds you instead of you trying to sort of be all things to all people.
Yeah, because you can't do that.
Yeah.
Although I've been lucky because I have such an eclectic crowd. It varies so much. I have older people, I have younger people from, you know, SNL people, like, you know, that watch me grow at my age.
Yeah.
Then I have other people, you know, in their 30s and late 20s that love Weeds.
Yeah.
I have housewives that love all my pieces on Ellen.
Yeah.
The Ellen Show and Adam Sandler fans. You know, so I've been really lucky.
Yeah.
So I have a pretty diverse crowd.
Well, you're a really good writer. No, you're not. And I did your thing on you. Now, this has really been a huge treat. I've just been a big fan for a long, long
time. Paul.
So thank you for doing this. And you should now put your pants back on. Thank you, sir.
How dare you?
Okay, that was Kevin Nealon. So funny. Really meant it. He was somebody I've always admired. Really subtle, really, really funny. And can act. Just a really, really, really talented guy. Thanks. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And please leave some comments on iTunes, and please send the link around, and we will see you next week.